Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk with Robert Wintner, owner and founder of Snorkel Bob Shops in Hawaii and author of a new book, Some Fishes I Have Known. We'll talk about his experiences as a businessman in Hawaii's coral reef tourism industry, his fervent message to stop the aquarium trade, and some of the fishes he has known. But first, let me play you today's creature call. This week's creature call comes from one of the most endangered seal species. Now listen carefully and see if you can guess what it is. At the end of the show, I'll play these sounds again and tell you what kind of animal made them. Now, let me turn to my conversation with Robert Wintner, owner and founder of Snorkel Bob Shops in Hawaii and author of a new book, Some Fishes I Have Known. He'll explain why Hawaii's coral reefs are so special, threats to the reefs from the marine aquarium trade, and how recent legislation in Maui County could reduce its impacts. We'll also get to explore Hawaii's coral reefs as Snorkel Bob takes us underwater to talk about some of the fishes he's known. We'll get to meet the Hawaiian cleaner wrasse and hear how this unusual fish sets up cleaning stations on the reef, where fish virtually line up to have parasites and other debris removed. The Hawaiian cleaner wrasse, in addition to serving this critical service in the ecosystem, is just one of the species targeted for the aquarium trade. Unfortunately, once removed from its natural habitat, their survival rates are extremely low. Robert Wintner recalls his first underwater adventure, a day in 1955 when his father took him to Walgreens in Miami, Florida for a $2 mask and snorkel, you know, the deluxe version with the ping pong ball, and then down to the beach and into the shallows. The old man's wingtips got soaked as he put his face in the water and saw a 3-inch sand crab waving a claw in greeting. Today, Wintner is owner of Snorkel Bob Shops in the state of Hawaii, executive director of the Snorkel Bob Foundation, and an advocate to protect Hawaii's reefs. The Snorkel Bob Foundation focuses on nearshore reefs, and Robert Wintner has been the lead advocate for eliminating and regulating the aquarium trade in Hawaii. From 2007 to 2010, he led legislative campaigns at the Hawaii State Capitol and in Maui County, which brought the plunder from aquarium trade into the light of day. However, with what he sees as a grim reality of empty reefs facing the people of Hawaii, Wintner will continue his legislative efforts. When we spoke, I asked Robert how he first got interested in the ocean.
I don't know that interest in the ocean is something that happens as a first-get event. I think that there's a little bit of mystique and curiosity, and it develops to the next step. And I do remember the day it was 1955, and my father, who was not, a physical person at all, that's a different subject altogether. He was a pretty rough and tumble guy, but he didn't get exercise. He wasn't an aerobic kind of guy. And in those days, mid-50s, of course, he was wearing pleated cuffed slacks and wingtip shoes. And I started whining, and don't ask me why, but I saw people with those rubber things on their face and the little breathing tubes with a little plastic cage at the top and a little ping pong ball, and I really wanted one. And so we went down to Walgreens, and we got the very best they had, the deluxe model. It was, I think it was $2, which in those days was, sit-down dinner. And we went down to the beach. This was in Miami. And he said, well, you can't go out very far, meaning about 4 feet. And the water was probably 10, as I recall. Of course, everything's bigger when you're that small. The water was about 10 to 18 inches deep, and I stuck my face. It was, it was small surf. And there was a tiny sand crab, and he waved his claw up, and it was I don't know if I'd call it an epiphany, but it was a moment of communion. I was just awestruck. There are times in people's lives when they their minds get moved to that, profound dimension. I used to be glib and say, like, the first time, do you remember the first time you took psychedelic drugs? I don't say that anymore. But it was, a first experience of profound proportion. And it was just a different reality, and one that just, to me, was, I just wanted more. And I'm not the only one to experience that. You know, that's the whole magic of snorkeling. People can hang out on a reef for hours and stare at these fish, and they go back tomorrow and do it again. Why do they do it? It feels good. It feels good to the brain. It feels good in the heart. So I'm one of those people.
So did you have that same profound reality the first time you ever dove?
Well, yeah, diving is different because you have that, the oh my God effect of breathing underwater. And again, and diving is far more complicated. You have all, you know, you have 70 pounds worth of equipment, or 55 to 70, depending on how much equipment you got. And there's all this stuff you got to pay attention to. So these layers of complexity give you a little bit more mobility at depth. And the more you dive, the less you have to think about these things, meaning they become second nature. If you become complacent, then it's going to be dangerous. If you want to get up close and personal with the fish, you got to be down there, 25 to however many feet you want to go. Other places, for example, I love Tahiti. Most of the islands in French Polynesia, except for the Marquesa group, are fringing atoll reefs. The islands are surrounded by reef that actually comes out of the water way out there. And in the inside are lagoons, and they range in depth. Most of them are fairly shallow, 6 to 12 feet range. And that's a snorkel outing. And it's so, it feels so liberating because you don't have the tanks, the wetsuit, all that, you know, the weight belt, all that stuff, and you're free and easy. So I love snorkeling, and I'm very fond of diving for what it can put me up next to.
Now, you're something of a local celebrity, both because you're a writer and also you're the founder and owner of Snorkel Bob's. So I'd love for you to describe, what is Snorkel Bob's for people who don't know or don't live in Hawaii or haven't visited?
Yeah, Snorkel Bob's is a reef outfitter. We have stores all over Hawaii, and we provide masks, fins, snorkels, and, sundry other things like boogie boards and all the toys you need to have fun at the beach. And it's mostly, we like to think of it as a public utility. You need, water, electricity, and snorkel gear. And we've been in business for a long time, and I think that there's two reasons why we've been successful. I think to be good at anything, you really, it really helps to a huge degree if you like that thing. If it's drudgery, yeah, you can still do a good job, but it probably won't have that certain je ne sais quoi. And I and the whole staff, we love it, and we love what we do, and we love it when we can make progress. And so we have always focused on service and quality. The quality, you know, in the scuba industry became questionable on many levels for our needs. You know, you could get a $105, $115 mask, and it was just too frail. And it was also too fa-fa. They put these little designs on the outside, and it's just form should follow function. So long story short, we started to design and manufacture our own equipment some years ago, and it was really one of the very best things we did because we're dealing with people all the way from seasoned ocean people to people who've never even seen the ocean, except, of course, on TV. And so the equipment has to be, it cannot claim a presence. It has to be there as if it's a natural extension of the body. And it is. And so we make stuff that works well. That's one of the, I think, primary sources of our success. And the other is we run a pretty smart company. Our marketing is pretty much against the grain. We often just push the limit on good taste, always good humor. And I think a classic example was when same-sex marriage first came up. Most people don't remember this, but one of the very first testing grounds was Hawaii. And you had the religious right people doing roadside demonstrations with signs on the sinful ways of same-sex marriage people. And then you had the same-sex marriage people doing roadside demonstrations on give us our freedom. And it was the same old rock and roll. And we came out with an ad. I got a little wedding veil for the cat. And we did, long story short, we did a shot at 40 feet. I had on a sky blue tuxedo and a baby blue ruffled shirt and a bow tie and a top hat. And I had the cat under my arm and a mask and snorkel that was custom made for the cat. And the headline was Snorkel Bob Weds Cat. You know, the great thing about it was that all the gay community laughed and said, look at that. There's a perfect example of what we're talking about. And the religious right people said, look at that. That's exactly what we're talking about. And we felt that we were great peacemakers at the time because everybody was laughing. And that was really one of our most successful ads. And we've really pushed the envelope like that on several other issues, too.
Now, some of your humor and perspective is in your most recent book, Some Fishes I Have Known, which was recently released. And in it, I mean, you describe it as a non-scientific book that views fish as individuals and provides insights into the lives and homes of reef fish while pointing out a dark undercurrent, namely the aquarium trade that's sweeping reefs clean around the world. And I'm wondering if you could take us into that world. The book itself, Some Fishes I Have Known, has amazing pictures that just jump off the page. But most listeners have never been snorkeling anywhere and probably have never visited Hawaii. So I'd love for you to take us underwater and describe, you know, some of the fish you have known.
Well, first off, thank you for that. I love it when you talk like that. Some Fishes I Have Known, you know, what is it, 300 shots on 200 pages, and it's a large format book, I think 8.5 by 11. And I went into it really not analyzing things. I got perspective on it once it was done. Far more fish book authors in the world are better ichthyologists than I am. That's, you know, a fish scientist such as it is. And they all take the approach, it's really cold and clinical. It's a cold fish of a subject, stomach count, scales, fin count, contents of stomach, the rows of teeth. And, you know, the only way they can do that is to catch the fish, kill the fish humanely, of course. I mean, that's an oxymoron. And then lay it out and cut it open and count and give you the results. And no one's going to read a book like that. It might be a reference book, but to read it, there's no story there. It's a collection of data with the fish as sacrificial subjects. And there are far more people in the world who are better photographers than I am. And they all take the approach, or tend to take the approach, of technical essence, excellence in photography. And I'm thinking particularly of either super macro, which is extreme close-up, where you can get the literal cell divisions in you know, a tiny goby's eyes, or a shrimp's eyes, or they'll go wide angle and give you just beautiful masterpiece shots. But nobody has really approached fish society. And that phrase would raise a few eyebrows. What the hell is this guy talking about? Society. And the thing that I didn't discover, it's, again, one of those things that just develops and all of a sudden you realize what's going on, and it's this. If you live in a place with warm water and reefs, you are very likely going to visit those reefs because it's one of the huge bonuses of living in that place. And they're places of beauty and solace and fun and all the good things about life that you can think of. And when you go to those places for the very first time, you will encounter fish. And, of course, some fish by nature are more shy than others. And in most fish books, you'll hear the habits of a species described in general terms. It's like saying, well, humans tend to be aggressive, or humans tend to be shy. And what we know is that some humans are aggressive and some humans are shy. And I'm here to tell you that nobody's ever said that about fish, and the same thing is true. And so you go to these reefs, and you will meet fish. And when you go on a regular basis, they become acquaintances. And when you go on a regular basis, some of those acquaintances become friends. I don't know if you have the book handy, Laurel, but if you look at the back cover, you will see a picture of a peacock razor wrasse. Now, that particular fish, and I'm talking about that individual, lives on the north edge of the sand channel, about 55 to 65 feet deep, because the sand channel kind of slopes down. at Mulakini Crater just off Maui. And the first time I visited there, not snorkeling, I was naturally had on scuba gear, he approached, with some circumspect caution, who are you, what do you want, you look strange, I've never seen a fish like you. And he kind of, a lot of fish, they don't have eyes in front of their faces, it's on either side of their head. And so he kept turning sideways and putting an eye up to me. And after a few visits, I mean, granted, this guy is quite accustomed to tourist traffic because that's a popular dive spot. It's a reserve, and the dive companies want to take their guests where they're going to find fish. But I have, a pretty identifiable camera, and the strobes stick out like, giant insect eyeballs. And at this point, he's a peacock razor ass. At this point, I call him Razor Boy. Now, when Razor Boy sees me, he just makes a dart right to me. He'll go about either right into my lens for a few frontal face shots. He'll do a back and forth, and then he'll go right down to the bottom, which is usually about a foot below us, and he'll start sifting schmutz for my benefit. And, what do you got? What do you got? What are we going to do? What are we going to do? And he's just a character. And he's a friend of mine. Okay? And, it's just a happy experience and a happy component of daily life. And so when I make reference to the dark hobby or the dark current or the darkness in general, I'm talking about personal friends who happen to be fish, and you know where they live, and you visit them. And the only reason they don't visit you is they don't have the equipment to come up and come into your neighborhood, or they would. And these are sociable beings, and somebody is coming up and grabbing them in a net and taking them away for a dramatically abbreviated life, for some other person's amusement thousands of miles away from the reef. And so this gets down to morality, not only for the life of the individual fish, which I'm concerned with, and I don't expect everyone to agree with me. I think more people are starting to think about this than used to, and seeing that perspective. And the other thing is morality as far as reef management goes. Every fish performs a function on the reef. What we know is that nature is perfectly balanced. The only aspect of nature that's not balanced are in those species that are known as indicator species, and that's the species whose propagation is uncontrolled and becomes so great it indicates an imbalance. The typical species that are indicator species might be rats, lemmings, roaches, humans, sorry. That's the way it is. And there are many morality issues around that too. I think that, for example, the aquarium trade in Hawaii, it's not complicated in the least. It's X millions, and this becomes a real bone of contention. What we think the average number of fish pulled from Hawaii reefs annually is between 2 and 10 million. We don't think that that's accurate. We think that what's accurate is the mid-range, about 5 to 6 million fish a year.
Just from the state of Hawaii waters.
That's right. That's right. We don't have the fish that we used to have. And people say that I'm wrong to say that because that's bad for tourism. Yeah, that's bad for tourism. Me saying it is the truth. And I think that our reefs are going to recover and rebound. In a minute, we're going to talk about progress that we've already made on Maui, which is the jewel in the crown, I'm here to tell you, passing the only regulation the state of Hawaii has seen ever on this crime against nature. But first, I want to make this important, illustration, which is on the morality issue, that one of the biggest threats to our reefs is suffocation by algae. Coralline algae is on all reefs. It grows there, and it grows there for a reason, because it serves as a food source in the food chain. It's the bottom of the food chain. That's why, the whole issue of shark finning is so important. Sharks are apex predators. If you remove all the apex predators, the fish that they prey on then become too populated, and they eat everything below them. You have an imbalance, and that's one of the things that adds dramatically to reef decline. Of the millions of fish taken every year from Hawaii reefs, something like 65 to 80%, depending on the year, are herbivores. They're yellow tangs. Anybody who's ever had chickens or been around chickens knows that that chickens work from dawn to dusk, peck and scratch, peck and scratch. And they enjoy it. They earn their living. That's what they do. With chickens, they eat, well, around here, they eat roaches, centipedes, scorpions, ants, you name it. On the reef, the yellow tangs and the other herbivores work like chickens, pecking the algae off the coral. And when you take millions of herbivores off the reefs are suffocated with algae. And the state of Hawaii has done nothing. And I also have to make a delineation there. The state legislature, and I've met with most of the representatives and senators in the Hawaii state legislature, and to a person, they want this stopped. But we've been stonewalled the last few years by the Lingo administration, which is an R, has a chief policy advisor who was wholesale distributor to the aquarium trade, and who told me point, and I mean blank, with her eyes popped out, don't tell me about this trade, mister, I know this trade. And her idea was to have an aquarium trade the world would envy. But she's not a water person, and she doesn't know it. She doesn't understand it. She understands one thing only, and that's dollars. And that's, I think, the change that has to happen in our culture, in our society, is a realignment of values. It's again, it's not complicated. If you have a goose and it lays golden egg and you cut it open, get to all the eggs, we know what happens. You lose the goose.
So how important is the aquarium trade to Hawaii, and how does that compare really to the tourism?
Well, I'm glad you asked. I can tell you that on campaigns at the state legislature over the last few years, we have developed three cases on this subject. Now, the first case has to do with conservation, and I've given you some of the components of that case already, and it's a no-brainer. If you want something to, in this case, rejuvenate, revive, and regain its balance, you have to manage it with conservation in mind. Conservation, and in each case we present here, depends on who we're talking to. Conservation was a non-starter. Nobody cares. Let me put it this way. I shouldn't say they don't care. I'm sure they do. At least some of them do. But they got no place to go with conservation. This is a very practical place. The second case we developed was Hawaiian culture, what is commonly called the host culture. Now, Hawaiian culture was severely disrespected and ignored for, you know, probably a little over a century. And when the missionaries achieved enlightenment and all the other things they had to sell and then ended up owning all the land, the Hawaiian culture was really cast into darkness. Some of the details are just mind-boggling. Couldn't dance the hula, had to wear shoes. That's why they planted kiawe, because of the big thorns. Couldn't go barefoot. And the Hawaiian culture case got a little bit of response because Hawaiian culture is enjoying a resurgence now, a renaissance. And so the Hawaiian culture case was a little bit stronger than conservation. Case that got the attention at the legislature was the economic case. The state agency authorized to, and I use the term really loosely, which is manage reefs, is the Department of Land and Natural Resources. And it's a political plum. It's designed to be the voice of the executive branch, and it can make rules, administrative rules, as opposed to laws, which have to go through the legislature. And the legislative process is really tedious, time-consuming, laborious, and very difficult. Administrative rules can happen overnight, and it gives the executive a shortcut on pressing problems. But when you have an executive branch that's pretty much influenced by a woman who was a wholesale distributor for the aquarium trade, we're not going to get any sympathy at all, either on administrative rules or legislative efforts. So the economy, in short, is this. Aquarium collectors in Hawaii are requested to fill out catch reports. How many fish did you catch? Total reported catch in the state of Hawaii for years was, say, it's a 500,000 to 1,000,000 fish. It's going up a little bit lately, or at least the report is going up. And again, two-thirds of those are yellow tangs. And that's what people thought was being taken from our reefs. Now, a few years ago, we had a little bit of an enclave in South Maui, Senator Roz Baker's conference chambers. And one of the people in that enclave was one of the biggest, if not the biggest, exporters of Hawaii reef fish. And he said it's not between a half million and a million fish. And at those days, I think the average price that a fish left in Hawaii was $2. And well, now it's $3, and let's say it's between a million and 2 million fish is the reported level. This guy said that he alone ships out a million yellow tangs a year, and that the state knows about 15 exporters, and there's 10 more in unmarked buildings shipping out fish. And he estimated it was about a $20 million a year gross revenue to the state, which, of course, is a lot of money if you have it in your pocket. But keep that number in mind, $20 million. It's for a state of several million people. Tourism, reef-based tourism, brings in $800 million a year.
And that's just reef-based tourism versus sports or other.
Correct, yes. And the other component of this that just, you know, it boggles the mind on plain common sense is if someone goes snorkeling or diving, they look at the fish, and then they go home on Saturday, and on Sunday another tourist arrives, and he goes and looks at the same fish. If the aquarium collector takes the fish, $3 over and out, the end.
So really, the tourism is a renewable resource that just gets recycled and earns more and more versus the collecting, which
it's not even renewable. You're never taking away in the first place. And I will say this, you know, there's been a case built against tourism based upon reef damage caused by tourists. And I will freely admit any coral that is shallower than 5 feet will be trashed by tourists. I don't care how many times you lecture them or beat them on the head with a wiffle ball bat, they're going to walk on that, on any coral they can reach. If they can't reach it, it won't be trashed. But that is manini, as we say in Hawaii. It's a trifle compared to extraction. Anytime you have extractive pursuits on a reef, you are looking for trouble. They call these fish ornamental, which I think is really misses the point. They have a whole set of jargon. They don't like to use the term aquarium collector. They like to use tropical fish, I don't know what they call themselves, tropical fish fishermen or something. And it's got very little to do with fishing. It's not fishing. And they want to make that link so they can get the fishing lobby on their side. They want to use all kinds of euphemism to take away. One of the things they do, there's a bill up now in Maui County Council on humane treatment. And one of the things they do before they ship a fish to the aquarium wholesalers in, or resellers in California, is they starve it because they ship it in a plastic bag. They said, we don't call that starvation. We call that purging, because if the fish goes shishi in the bag, the fish dies. Well, if you starve the fish, some fish are also going to die, but it's not as many fish, so it's a little bit more cha-ching, cha-ching. You know, and they want to really focus on the idea that they can keep the fish alive off the reef. And we know that they can't, number one. Number two, that's not even the subject. They've already taken the fish from the reef. That's the subject. I tend to, you know, build up a little pressure internally when I get on this subject. Maybe you can tell. We've been on it for a long time. You know, I'm very proud of very few things. And I'm very proud. One of those things is Maui County Council. Because we have passed two ordinances. We cannot ban aquarium collecting because county jurisdiction ends at the high water mark. All ocean waters are state jurisdiction, and we've been stonewalled at state level. Now, luckily, we're going to have a new administration here in just a few months. And so we're all optimistic about that, about a reasonable approach to caring for what is so dear to Hawaii. But in the meantime, Maui County has made the aquarium business anywhere in Maui County. And most people don't realize that Maui County includes the islands of Lanai and Molokai. And if you want to have an aquarium business in Maui County, get your checkbook out and get ready to dance on animal cruelty issues, on mortality count, on tax clearances, because that's what Maui County has stepped up and required. I think some of the comments of the council members best captured the sentiment here. It's an emphasis on who we are, what we are, where we are, and how we take care of it.
Maui is leading on this issue, and just to back up a little bit, a bill passed in August 2010 for Maui County only that passed strict permit requirements on aquarium collecting. Is that correct?
Correct.
And it also, can you describe the bill and what it requires?
The bill is about four or five pages long, and it describes you have to have a facility that may be inspected because it's happened in residential areas. These guys have these jumbo containers of pure oxygen, which is hazmat. And in Maui County, you know, hazmat is hazardous material. It's legal to have hazardous material, the jumbo oxygen containers, in residential areas, but only if you follow OSHA standards. Now, these stuff can explode. It's oxygen. There's all kinds of little things you have to do that aren't being done. I mean, neighborhoods could blow up. Now they have to, you know, meet those standards, and I think they have to be in an area that's zoned for business. I can't remember that detail. And they have to file catch reports, including mortality rates by species. This is huge. They have to pay permit fees. If you want to run a tourist operation now off a Maui County beach, you have to buy permits that are specific to that beach. You want to do it off a different beach sometimes, you got to buy that permit too. It's several thousand dollars. Now the aquarium collectors will have to buy permits as well. They've had a free ride this whole time. And then the other thing is tax clearances. You know, when they catch, say, 1,000 fish and they fill out their report and says, okay, we caught 150 fish, they're going to pay tax on 150 fish. So now they have to have tax clearances. It was interesting. A bunch of interesting stuff showed up in testimony when we had hearings on this permit bill. And one of the things that came up that surfaced was that you have the collectors sell their fish to the dealers, and the dealers ship the fish off to all points, west, east, and everywhere. The dealers have to fill out reports saying how many fish they sold, and the collectors are requested to fill out reports on how many fish they caught. One year, one dealer sold more fish than all the collectors put together caught.
So clearly something's going on here.
Yeah. I mean, it's laughable, and everybody did laugh. But until you have prima facie evidence, then, you know, it's just a supposition. But we do have it, and we knew it anyway, but now it's proven. But now they have to have tax clearances, and they can still do it in Maui County. But I'm pleased to say that one of the unintended consequences, and of course that was the great opposition that we got, you're going to have unintended consequences. The biggest collector on Maui and his wife, who is a dealer, have both moved to Kona. It was, and we apologize, it was an unintended consequence. I had, you know, reasonable conversations with both the guy and his wife on what we might do. And it came down to we could do very little by way of compromise without somebody compromising moral standards. And I told this fellow that what I could perceive in him was really profound water skills. And if you could apply those skills to a productive pursuit, for example, algae cultivation and reseeding reefs that had been oppressed, that I would help seeking funding on that project. Anyway, he and the wife moved to Kona. And I think that's pretty good indication of how tough it's going to be to do business here on Maui in this trade. So we're quite pleased. And, of course, the second bill deals specifically with animal cruelty. It was such a push, and now we're looking towards the new legislative season and at the state level, a new administration, new leadership in the House and the Senate, and we think we're looking pretty good. And we know for a fact that this industry, and I'm here to tell you, you know, the $20 million that this industry leaves in Hawaii is really chump change compared to the billions that this industry generates across America and worldwide. Because without Hawaii fish, they're severely limited in sales of tanks, stands, lights, pumps, you name it. And it's very expensive hardware, and they need what they call this livestock. One of the aquarium authorities who lives on the Big Island actually came out and said that, yes, it's a shame, 99% of all these fish die within a year. But they are necessary livestock to drive hard goods sales. And that's very close to a quote, if not a quote. Now, this guy is a real horse's patootie. He said, of course I said that when taking the test. Of course I said that, 99% die in the year. But the fact is, in the wild, more than that die, more than 99% die. First off, I think his number is wrong. But secondly, the argument itself is once again spurious. These guys have tried for the last few years, since we're bringing this up to the surface, have tried to link aquarium hunting with fishing, and it's not the same. And now we're getting really hardcore Hawaiian fishing families coming in from the boonies to testify. And one of the guys testified at the recent hearings, and his family's been fishing out in Hana for generations. He said that they very rarely get Ono anymore. Ono is O-N-O. It's a big, like a giant mackerel. It's the same, very similar to the species in the Atlantic known as wahoo. It's a pelagic game fish, fierce hunter, and quite desirable for eating. He said that they went out a couple weeks ago and they got an Ono, and inside that Ono were a bunch of yellow tangs. And he said that Ono was successful, but the reason that they're not seeing so many Ono anymore is the aquarium hunters are taking all the yellow tangs. So it begs the point that this guy is trying to make, that fewer than 1% survive in the wild. In the wild, they are supporting a balanced food chain. And when you extract from an amusement industry, and this guy was Hawaiian, and he said it, it's an insult to the host culture. It's an insult to the balance in management that the host culture used for years before Western government took over.
Compared to other places, how much does Hawaii, you know, fish from Hawaii reefs contribute to the worldwide aquarium trade?
And I can't tell you what the exact percentage is of the number of fish that are from Hawaii as a percentage in tanks worldwide. I know it's significant. And one of the arguments we get from the trade, and again, these arguments are so spurious and disingenuous, is that you're making a big mistake here by not letting us take fish from Hawaii, because if you do that, you're just going to put more pressure on other reefs. And my response to that is, well, first we'll shut you down in Hawaii, and then we'll shut you down in the other places. And what they're so much as saying is no other place has a government that can do the right thing beyond concerns for short-term revenue.
Do you have examples of what's going on in other countries?
You know, if you look at places like, you know, in Central America, there's Bonaire, Aruba, where they actually have rules that you can't even touch the coral. And there's a rule on the Great Barrier Reef, you can't touch the coral. These places have thriving tourism economies that are worth exponentially more money than extracting aquarium fish. And so, you know, it's the sort of thing that when you're talking about that much money, things are going to get heated up. And there's no getting around it, because money is what makes the world go round, regardless of how many people say it's love. We like to think that we represent some of the love, too.
Now, a lot of the fish in the trade are endemics, meaning found only in Hawaii, and I'd love for you to take us back underwater to describe how the extraction of these fish changed the ecology. And one that I was taken by in the photos from your book, Some Fishes I Have Known, is the Hawaiian cleaner wrasse, which looks very strange.
Yeah.
And I'd love for you to describe it and tell me about one that you knew.
Yeah. I call them all by the same name. I call them cleaner boy. The Hawaiian cleaner wrasse is endemic. You know, if you go to different reefs around the world, every reef has a species responsible for the cleaning function. I was in St. Croix earlier this year, And on that reef, it's a small, very colorful goby that performs the cleaning function. In Hawaii, it's the Hawaiian cleaner wrasse, and it is endemic, found nowhere else. This fish is technically described as charismatic, and he is a character. He's got a natural kind of full lips and a smile. He's about 3 inches long, or she. Both genders have the same coloration in Hawaiian cleaner wrasse. It's a brilliant sunburst yellow across the top half above the lateral line with an essence, if you will, of iridescent purple going back to blue with a little black and a little more red, and a remarkable fish. Most cases they're unapproachable. You do get lucky. I got lucky a few times where you can get them to hold still long enough to stay in focus. All wrasses have an unusual stroke when they swim. It's almost like they have no buoyancy, and they're propelled by their pectoral fins, and they'll get a little bit of forward momentum, and then the body sinks a little bit, and then a little bit more forward momentum come up and move, and then they sink a little bit, and they're remarkable to watch. And if you go to any reef, you can find the cleaning station. Back at the sand channel at Molokini Crater on the southern edge, there are probably four or five cleaning stations, and you'll get anywhere from one to three or four or five Hawaiian cleaner wrasses setting up a little area. And I'm not exaggerating.
I'm picturing like an interstate with, you know, the one, the one gas station there.
The fish line up like it's a car wash. And a fish will move into place. He'll spread his pectoral fins out to the side. His dorsal fin will come straight out and flare. And the cleaners will come in. And it's unbelievable. Well, you've seen some of the shots in the book where...
it's amazing.
They look like they're actually... I entitled one. I don't know, Marty. What do you want to do? Where there's this huge, sleek unicorn, probably in the 4 to 5 pound range, and this cleaner ass in about the 1 ounce range, and they're going nose to nose, smiling at each other. And the big, sleek unicorn has his dorsal fin all flared out, and they're getting ready for a cleaning. And when you get huge predators like, big yellow margin moray eels and all the eels, really, they will open wide and the cleaners will come in. And this includes cleaner shrimp, too. They'll come into the maw and clean the goobers off the teeth. The fish will flex his gill plates and the cleaners will come in and eat the goobers off the gill plates. I have seen goatfish, and that's kind of it's a beautiful fish, especially if you get them up close with the coloration. I'm trying to picture this for our listeners. He's shaped, I guess, a little bit like a long, skinny carp, and he has chin barbels that he uses to sift the stuff in the sand. And the goatfish will open wide in a semi-pucker, and I've seen Hawaiian cleaner wrasse go down into his mouth, and it looks like the goatfish is eating him. But actually, the cleaner wrasse is picking goobers off the goatfish's tonsils.
No way!
He slides out. I'm not kidding. He'll slide out. In fact, one of our guest photographers, Mike Richards, really a great photographer, he got that shot, and he got it just classic masterpiece shot. When the cleaners clean, back to your question on balance, reef balance and endemics and what it means, when the cleaners clean, what they're doing is picking parasites off the skin and scales of the fish. It's not just goobers out of the gill plates and teeth and all that. It's literally living parasites. And if people think that sounds disgusting, everybody has parasites. And by everybody, I mean humans and fish. And so a cleaner wrasse in captivity will starve to death in about 30 days unless he has 30 to 40 other fish to clean. And I think you could probably count the tanks in the world with 30 or 40 other fish in them in two digits. And I don't have any basis for that opinion. Let me just say there's very few. So they all die. If you go online right now and look at Hawaiian cleaner wrasse for sale, you can buy them online for about $55. There's one guy in Taiwan who likes to sell Hawaiian clean wrasse, and all the fish he sells, he has to show them online by catching them in his hand and holding his hand up to the camera. This is very offensive to those of us who consider these fish friends and an integral part of nature. And the guy has to do this to compensate for some deficiency internal. Otherwise, he wouldn't do it. You look at his offerings online, you wonder, why does he have, he's in Taiwan, and these are definitely fish from Hawaii reefs because they're not found anywhere else. And you ask yourself, why does he have to put them in his hand to take the picture? And it's to show, I control this living thing. I am dominant here. There's another website that's particularly heinous, pardon me, and they set up a dive trip. You know, dive travel is very popular these days. They set up a trip, come to Hawaii, catch your own aquarium fish. And one of the shots on their website shows a guy with a Moorish idol. I have to describe this. For those of you who saw Nemo, the Moorish idol was kind of the cynical, sanguine character. I mean, I have to remind myself of Nemo with a cartoon. But he's kind of diamond-shaped. He has a huge dorsal streamer. And he has these beautiful fish. And he's got bars in white and black. And then everything is kind of tinged or trimmed in yellow. He's got the Moorish idol has a long snout with full lips, and he has very defined eyelashes, or they look like eyelashes. Just a beautiful, remarkable fish. And here was a guy who had a Moorish idol grasped in his hand, held above the surface of the water for a photograph. People in Hawaii see that. Let me just say, he got everybody's blood boiling, and maybe he didn't realize it. Maybe he did realize it. Like I say, it's become contentious. With the Hawaiian clean wrasse, Moorish idols also eat sponges, and they're known to die in short order, guaranteed. But these fish are shipped with a 15-day live guarantee. Most of them starve to death in 30. The consequence to the reef, especially with Hawaiian clean wrasses, is when you take the clean wrasses off a reef, that reef is subject to parasite infestation. And there's another hole in the dike, and we're failing. The reefs are in decline, and these guys catch Hawaiian clean wrasses. And again, this is my mantra for this campaign and has been for a number of years, and this is the bottom line right here. No limit on the catch. No limit on the number of catchers. No constraint or protection for vanishing, rare, or endemic species. It is a free-for-all on Hawaii reefs. And it must end. And I got to say, the good news, which is the end has begun in Maui County. And we have some opposition. You better believe it, because there's dollars at stake here.
And if people are interested in this issue and want to help, where would you recommend they go to find more information, or what would you recommend that they do?
Well, we try to keep things fairly up to date on the Snorkel Bob website. The website that really has become our clearinghouse of data and information is forthefishes.org. That's forthefishes.org. And, you know, when we have breaking news, we put it up there immediately. And so all this stuff, you know, is our whole crew – it's volunteer. So, and this is, as you can tell, it's often full time and then some, because we're trying to move the rock here. So if we're a little tardy on getting information up there, bear with us. When we have breaking news, we do get it up there in pretty short order. The main thing that people need to do, I get people all the time doing one of two things. Either they'll forward me a link. For example, last week there was a story in Star Advertiser in Honolulu on the wonders of keeping aquaria. Well, they had this very similar story in the New York Times that in their home and garden section. It was really untenable. And I'm happy to say that in the last hearing before Maui County Council, testimony was presented on the New York Times article, and 9 out of 9 Maui County Council members were fuming. and they voted 9-0 to pass this ordinance and say no to the New York Times and to the Honolulu Advertiser. But when these things come out, I get about 6 or 12 emails. Look what they did. Now get them. And, you know, my response is, I can't. I'm up to my neck in alligators. Can you please do me a favor and respond? So if you see these things, respond. Now, the second thing you can do, and this is very similar, but it's even more important. And I had a guy tell me last night that he was traveling with his wife, and they were in a hotel, and I think it was in California, and he saw a huge saltwater aquarium, and it really disgusted him, and he didn't know what to do. What you do is you go up to management, and you say, listen, I just want you to know that that I'm really displeased on seeing this aquarium. It really is exacting a huge cost to Hawaii Reef Health, and I wish you would take it down. I wish you would really consider something else there. And it does have an effect, and it's not just hotels. It's any place you see a saltwater aquarium. And that's really one of our fronts right now, is to go at the trade, at the hobbyists themselves. Well, there's two facets to the end-use consumers. One is home hobbyists, and the other are bistros, offices, hotels, lobbies, you name it. Wherever you see a saltwater aquarium, you're most often going to see a fish staring sadly out. You know, I have a second book, I hope it comes out next year, called Every Fish Tells a Story. And I open that, there's a guy here who died last year, Ed Lindsay, very dear friend. Ed was Hawaiian, and a real support and a real pillar in this campaign. And Ed liked to tell the story of when he was traveling in to California. He walked through a hotel lobby, and there was a saltwater aquarium. And he stopped, and there was a Hinalea. A Hinalea is a Hawaiian cleaner ass, and it was just hovering there staring. And Ed heard that fish.
He heard that fish.
He heard that fish. And he said he decided right then and there to let the world know it will always be welcome in the land of aloha, but it can no longer take what belongs here. And so I think what people can do at this stage, yeah, you can let your legislators know, you know, whatever they can do, and I'm not sure what that'll be at this point. I hope to know more in a few months, in coming months. But mostly when you're out and about, you don't have to make a scene unless you want to. I often do. Let them know that this is wrong, and it can't happen anymore. And it shouldn't happen. And with all due respect, that, you know, people vote with their dollars, and just let them know that your dollars will have to be spent elsewhere if they can't take that thing down, because there are alternatives.
What are some of the alternatives?
You can put up a nice painting. You can put up a bonsai. You can put up stained glass. One of the things that we're trying to work on now is a flat screen monitor with a reef cam, and we're looking into this right now as a free service. Who needs an aquarium? Here's live action on a reef. We're trying to look into, you know, what it would take even to power some lights for, you know, a certain amount of time at night. Now, how exciting is that? It's much more exciting than an aquarium. You're going to get your big predators. You're going to get your nocturnals. And so there are many alternatives, and I think that the challenge that we face right now is just letting people know. And I have had intelligent, informed people tell me, you know, I just assumed when I see an aquarium and a fish, I just assume it's like a thing. And there are people out there growing these things, and that's where they come from, and that's as far as I ever thought about it. I never realized that this is a devastating reef extraction. And that's the challenge, is to let the world know. And the aquarium collectors say, but we love those fish. And I think that many more of them are now seeing the difference between loving these fish and loving to keep these fish captive in a tank. There's a huge difference. This is a moral issue. It's the difference between right and wrong. And I think that we cannot get upset with society in general, because society has not thought about this. We all have very busy lives. But more people are thinking about it now, And I think that that's going to, you know, gain momentum. The more people think about it, then the more people will be talking about it, and even more people think about it. And so there you go.
Well, I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Laurel. And I hope we changed a few minds today and opened some eyes and got people thinking.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Robert Wintner, owner of Snorkel Bob's Dive Shops in Hawaii, about Hawaii's coral reefs and some fishes he has known. Now, let me play you today's creature call once again and see if you've guessed it correctly. This week's creature call is the sound of one of the world's most endangered seal species. It's the Hawaiian monk seal. The Hawaiian monk seal likely gets its name from the folds of skin around its face that look like a monk's hood, or else because it spends most of its time alone or in very small groups. Hawaiian monk seals are found only in the Hawaiian island chain. Their vocalizations can vary from a bubbling sound that originates deep in the throat for an alarmed adult to a more growling whoop sound when ascending from a dive. Listen to the sound of a Hawaiian monk seal. Archived episodes of The Wildlife are available on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.